Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I am Sikko Hirsink of the Mel Gibson Podcast, and today I am joined by Kyle of One More Round, the Rocky Series Podcast. He is here to be my voice of reason. He is also here because he's the network's martial arts expert, and he's also a responsible parent. Therefore, he's the perfect host to discuss our topic of today, the Karate Kid. Kyle, welcome. Good to finally talk to you.
It is great, and thank you for having me on the show.
Yes, well, this is our network special. So now, Karate Kid was directed by John G. Avildsen, and he also directed Rocky, perchance. And both movies are always cited as underdog movies. Now, is that correct, or are these things completely different, and do they have completely different themes? What's your take on that?
I think superficially, there are some similarities between the two films, but I think if you dive a little deeper into it, they're materially different. So you could say Karate Kid's an underdog movie in the sense that the Daniel kid is the new guy in town. He's experiencing some bullying, but I wouldn't say he's the same kind of underdog as Rocky.
Rocky beats people up.
Yeah.
He's a leg breaker for a living.
Yeah, Rocky is kind of like a loser in the sense that his life's going nowhere, that he didn't live up to his talent and potential, as Mickey told him in that famous scene in the gym, where he said you had the talent to become a good fighter, but instead of that, you became a leg breaker to a cheap second-rate loan shark. Mm-hmm. And Rocky, of course, gets that one-in-a-lifetime opportunity to fight the champ and kind of redeem himself and define that. Just to see how far his talent really goes. There's a similarity that there's both combat sports in both films. Mm-hmm. And there's also the similarity that there's the love interest. You have Rocky and Adrian, of course. Mm-hmm. Is Ryan from my co-host Ryan would say that the Rocky movies is really a love story as much as a boxing movie, which is debatable. But that's like the love story theme in Rocky is a major theme.
It's but there. It's what motivates Rocky.
Sure, yeah. Without Adrian, Rocky.
If Adrian doesn't like it, it will just not happen. That's basically the premise of every Rocky.
Yeah. He needs Adrian to sign off on those fights, or it's not happening.
Yeah, if she's in a coma, forget about it.
Yeah, exactly. And you have that buildup in the Rocky films, whereas in Karate Kid, you do have you have the romantic interest in Ali, but it's a lot more shallow than the Rocky films.
I think in the Karate Kid, it's a little bit more layered because Ali is the ex-girlfriend of the bully of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Like in reality, if Daniel just kind of moved on and tried to go after a different love interest, that gang of kids would have no interest in him at all.
One could argue he's fighting her battle.
Yeah, oh, for sure. For sure.
She's actually kind of the ringleader of that whole thing.
Yeah, she probably likes the attention to some degree.
Machiavellian.
and you have the theme, too, where they both take a lot of punishment, where Rocky takes a significant amount of punishment in the fight, and Daniel takes a significant amount of punishment to the point where he's pretty much physically disabled by the end of the fight there.
Well, and he's beaten up by multiple assailants. I mean, that's not just bullying. I mean, that's just beating people down.
Yeah, yeah,
it's exactly. Pretty brutal.
So yeah, there are some, like I said, there's some superficial similarities there, but I think in all reality, it's the films have a very different tone, and I don't think they're really that similar, to be honest.
No, neither do I. And with the exception of when you look at like the main protagonist, in this case, Daniel LaRusso. There's something off about him as much as there is off about Rocky. Rocky's kind of a weird guy, you know, socially challenged. And here you have LaRusso, who's a little obnoxious and he's kind of a moron. His mom makes him move and he has this kind of teenage upstart annoyance with his mother happening. He really doesn't want to go to California because leaving New York is just so awful. And so I guess he's at that age where he just feels a fish out of water everywhere. And why would you move at that point, right?
Well, yeah, I think being a teenager is a tough time for most people, and no one likes being uprooted because you have to make new friends and you have a new environment. But yeah, he has the Daniel character has a certain cockiness about him, a certain level of arrogance about him that Rocky didn't really have.
No, like Rocky didn't need arrogance.
No,
Rocky could swat people, whereas Daniel LaRusso, I mean, his arms are matchsticks. He should not be pretending he knows karate, and he should not be getting into fights with people, which he does at the start of the movie, which I found interesting.
Yeah, he's not afraid to throw a punch, for sure, against people who he has no business throwing punches at, really, in terms of whether you're going to win the fight or not.
Yeah, maybe back in New York, he was just used to bluffing himself out of fights and talking himself out of fights. There was little talking in California. Well, you put up or shut up.
Yeah, like he was tripped in the soccer field, for example, and he punched that guy in the face. Pretty big escalation. Like, you might give someone a shove or something to let them know that you're not okay with that, but punching in the face is a big escalation there. And I wonder if in New York,
especially in a no contact sport.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure.
I mean, this isn't Australian rules football where you can punch people. And
well, there is like the philosophy that if you're being bullied, even if the person's bigger and stronger than you, if you fight back and even if you lose, you're less likely to get bullied because the bullies themselves are a bit more cowardly and they want someone they could just pick on who doesn't fight back.
I don't think that's necessarily true, though.
I don't know. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. But
well, you pick on the weakest prey you can find.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And so
bullies tend to run in packs. That's what you see here. Those Cobra Kai kids are just a bunch of assholes, really. Kind of like a bunch of frat boys.
They are. They're frat bros, for sure.
And the ringleader is Johnny, and he's a two-time All-Valley Karate Champion. So he's like the big cheese. And so he has this little posse around him. So, of course, they egg him on, and someone's talking to your ex-girlfriend, Johnny. You know, they're always trying to take him down a peg. So he has to assert dominance.
He does. And there's really nothing you could do when you're facing off against an entire gang of people, too.
Yeah, maybe not throw a radio at him.
Yeah, true, true.
Maybe not be an aggressor, because he was the aggressor in that situation.
Well, yeah, he wanted to be the hero, because he saw Johnny, because Johnny was approaching Allie, and she didn't want to talk to him, and he was being aggressive with her, and then Daniel comes in to kind of try to be the white knight. And Johnny kind of shoves the radio at him, and then he does it back, and then the fight ensues, right? I think a lot of people would just mind their business to be like, why? This girl's too much trouble. I'll find someone else.
Yeah. I mean, if guys on motorcycles show up, that's usually the part where you exit the scene.
Yeah. But he has those teenage hormones too. I think he was set on that girl, and the hormones took over the reasoning part of his brain, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And he also thought he could play soccer, which was interesting. He's constantly bouncing the ball on his knee and showing her how he can play soccer, which, interestingly enough, Elizabeth Shue was a college level, almost a pro soccer player. So she actually had to teach him soccer tricks in order for Ralph Macchio to look good on film.
Yeah, I got to tell you too, you Europeans are much better at that sport than we are.
Yes, and well, here you go, European thing. So the rest of the world, really, because football, of course, is the sport of the world. And then you have American football. I think there's also a Canadian league. And that's, we sort of see it as a kind of a rugby version. And we just think of it as a sissy rugby version with pads and helmets on. But if you look at, like, they have that little altercation on the soccer field, and any European or anyone remotely familiar with soccer looking at that is like, what is he doing? I mean, he got tripped. And in soccer, when you get tripped, you feign an injury immediately. Sure. You can play, you're crying, you'll never play again. And that's how your team gets a free throw or a free kick. But instead of doing that, he punches his opponent in the face. That's an immediate red card. This is ejected also from the field.
This is high school gym soccer.
So, but still, if you're a decent gym ed teacher, that's the moment you grab these kids and start explaining the rules to them. It's like, hey, guys, this is a learning moment we're having here. I mean, that's what a normal coach would do. But of course, Daniel has a little bit of plot armor. He's the victim in the situation, not the guy who's misinterpreting the rules.
True.
I guess you could say, because Daniel is a fish out of water in his new surroundings, he's misinterpreting every rule and he's stepping on all kinds of stuff and stepping into stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not being very cautious. He's going in there very aggressively, and he's rubbing a lot of people the wrong way.
Yeah. And you see that throughout the movie. It's just in his character.
Yeah. Yeah. He's very kind of in your face.
Yeah. And that's what kind of, I think, makes the theme interesting, because you have this scene where Mr. Miyagi is catching a fly with his chopsticks.
Sure. Yeah.
And he does this to train himself. He's never done it. So can I try? Daniel says. So he tries and boom, at a stroke of luck, he catches the fly. Oh, look, Mr. Miyagi, look. Mr. Miyagi's all out of sorts and, you know, beginner's luck.
Sure.
But is this, when I saw that scene again, I was thinking, is this foreshadowing Daniel's brilliance in the tournament?
Yes, 100% it is.
Is Daniel a prodigy? Does he have gifts and hidden talents that make him a great martial artist, even though you wouldn't think so looking at him? Is that the real underlying theme here?
Well,
not to judge the book by its cover.
Well, looking at him, like with martial artists, you don't have to be really big to be good at martial arts. Like it's not like heavyweight boxing, or even then there is a bit of a continuum between size and agility and other factors. But with martial artists, speed and power, like you don't see a ton of martial artists that are really bulky.
Mm-hmm.
So just looking at them, I don't have an issue there. But with martial arts, like anything, it takes years and years and years of practice to be good at it.
Yep.
You can't be that good no matter how much of a prodigy you are. Like,
interesting, right?
I mean, you know, maybe like a couple people in the world could be like that, perhaps, who are just naturally gifted athletes. But, you know, going by the probabilities, this guy is not one of them. And it is a bit of anyone who does any type of sport like that, whether it's boxing or karate or jiu-jitsu or whatever, sees him lighting up people in this tournament, they have to suspend their disbelief.
Mm, a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he only trained for what, 6 weeks?
If that. And it's also, he was doing like painting a fence and sanding a deck. And I understand those
motoric skills.
Yeah. They were teaching him certain elements of a certain karate style, which we can get into, but that's not going to get you fighting and beating up people in a tournament. As much as I don't like the Cobra Kai guys.
They're great athletes.
Yeah, and they actually put the work in and they practice. They're at that dojo. And I don't like the guy who runs the dojo either. But at the end of the day, they're putting in the time and effort. And in that way, it's like, you do deserve to win the tournament. It is kind of an insult for some kid to come in there and just win. Like, he didn't know how to put on a gi.
He had no idea how to score points at the tournament.
Yeah, he didn't know how to put his gi on.
Nope.
He didn't know where to tie it together right.
They had to steal a black belt for him.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so here's an interesting thing you mentioned. It's like you have a different in coaches here. There's Mr. Miyagi as coach, who is kind of the traditional Okinawan karate. And then there's Kreese, who is probably an army veteran, Vietnam veteran.
Yeah.
Probably has issues, who's teaching kids to fight to survive. And he has this kind of philosophy where you have to show no mercy and you have to be the first to strike. So here you have these opposite kind of, where's the balanced version of Mr. Miyagi. And when you go to Mr. Miyagi's house, everything's nice and serene and pretty trees. And, you know, they have a very relaxed way of training. And on the other hand, you have this like emotionally and frenetically charged dojo that's just aggressive and angry. And there's this groupthink happening. You're not supposed to think for yourself. You just have to follow orders.
Yeah. And it seems like the in that dojo, even too, if you're not performing well, you get weeded out. You have the child there in the dojo who remains nameless, who screwed up. And he was taken down by the instructor, and then he had to do a bunch of push-ups on his knuckles. And, you know, that guy's probably going to quit eventually.
Or maybe not. He'll just, like in Full Metal Jacket, he'll turn psycho.
Yes. And end up killing the instructor.
or someone on the street. Because sure. That's the kind of coach Kreese is, really. He creates monsters.
Yeah, it's very almost kind of Darwinian that you adapt to survive in that dojo.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it doesn't really teach them any ethics.
No. And that's in actual karate, that's a big thing. Mm-hmm. Like in the dojo I train at, you have a list of rules and principles. And most of them have to do with respecting other people.
Mm-hmm.
Both respecting your classmates and your sensei, as mm-hmm. well as just people in general, and being your best self.
Mm-hmm.
And like it's philosophical as much as it's a martial art as well. And you get the idea from Cobra Kai. It's clearly just a martial art, and that's it. Other than the philosophy of maybe no mercy on the street, it's kill or be killed. You got to mm-hmm. do this to survive type of thing. That's pretty antithetical to most martial arts that I'm aware of.
Arguably, you could say that Kreese doesn't get it and is doing a money grab. And he's hurting the kids he's training while he's doing it.
It is interesting when you say money grab. I was in karate yesterday and I was talking with my sensei about there are certain dojos. They'll be nicknamed Mick dojos
mm-hmm.
where you come in and you're constantly grading. And grading is how a lot of dojos make money. When you grade and test for your next belt,
mm-hmm.
you pay for that grading. It's not part of your monthly dojo fee mm-hmm. in most organizations. And so you have these Mick dojos where you're grading constantly and you're getting all these different stripes and stuff. And then you end up paying an enormous sum just to get a black belt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I noticed too, is that you have a bunch of these teenagers with black belts.
Yeah. How does that happen?
Yeah. And like, you do have some sketchy dojos out there where you get a black belt in a year or two, but it's like the style I'm in, it takes roughly 7 to 10 years to get a black belt.
At the very least.
Yeah. And you have to be over 18 to get a black belt. So it's like the idea of you had in the, when we first go into the Cobra Kai dojo, there's mm-hmm. maybe one or two teenagers that don't have a black belt.
Yeah. And they have a weird gi anyway.
Yeah. I've seen that at a tournament before where you have people with like a bizarre, and they were kind of a Mick dojo type of organization, and they didn't do well.
Yeah, I think the reality of it is if a Cobra Kai kind of organization would go into like a real karate tournament, they would have to change gis immediately because everybody has to wear the same, you know, competition gi.
Yeah.
Usually different colors.
I've been in tournaments where you have different styles, so you'll have slight differences in the gi, but they're similar enough. Like they're usually they're white, and they might have different like crests or something sewn onto them. But it's pretty obvious to everyone that it's a karate gi. So yeah, if you had a weird black one like that, like I've heard of that happening once where it was allowed at a tournament, but it was like. It wasn't very well liked. And I think they ended up putting some rules in to prevent that from happening in the future.
Yeah, because I remember when I was a kid, I came from judo and I had my judo gi. And then when I started with karate classes, they basically said, look, just wear a sweater next time. Don't wear a judo gi.
Yeah, I can see that.
Until you get a decent gi.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So how long have you been practicing karate?
I started in late 2017.
Mm.
So
you're kind of a latecomer to the game, eh?
Yeah. I basically wanted a hobby, something to do. Up until that point, I've been working on professional designations and things like that that took up most of my time outside of work, studying and doing other things. And I'm like, I want to be able to do something else, something more physical, but also challenging mentally as well. And karate seemed like a good fit for me.
Yeah, I'll bet. And it's a great way to stay in shape.
Yeah.
It's a good way of life.
Yeah, it's really good. It's something I plan to do continuously.
Yeah, I did karate I looked it up and I did karate for a total of like 19 months.
Okay.
Because like I said, I came out of judo And then I went into Kitty Karate, which is like Shotokan.
Yeah.
It was all really cute, but I was in, I think, in too much shape, because they would make us do like 10 push-ups, 10 sit-ups, you know, because they were all little kids, like 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds. And at that point, I was a calisthenics nut. I could do 100 push-ups.
Sure.
And you know how that goes. If you can do 100 push-ups, you start sparring with a kid who can do 10. You know, you break him apart. You make him cry. And I thought I was doing great. And everybody was just, you know, their moms were complaining. And it's like, okay. So at some point I got bumped up to Kyokushin, which is the kind of the teenage version of karate for us. Basically, Kyokushin is what you do before you go into kickboxing.
Okay.
It's more kick and more sweep based. It's also full contact. And so here I am, 11 years old, and I'm thrown in with the Lions, who can also do 100 push-ups. And those are 16, 17-year-old kids who weigh twice as much as I do, who have longer arms and longer legs. And if I'd get a point in on them, they'd wait outside because it's embarrassing. I mean, in retrospect, I get it. When an 11-year-old kid, you know, gets a point on you, you want to talk to him outside. And it's like, don't do that shit to me again. It's embarrassing. And so here's a nice blue eye to remind yourself.
Yeah, which is not very correct. Like that kind of goes against the principles of karate there.
It wasn't a very good school. And that's why I left, because I went to the sensei, of course. This was the same sensei who put me in that class because I was, you know, being an asshole to the guys my own age. He basically said, look, tough it out. This is your lot in life. Just deal with it. And I was like, but I'm getting beat up every week after class. And he's like, yeah, well, it'll just make you tough. And I was like, you know what it'll make me quit.
Yeah, you're almost in a little bit of a Cobra Kai kind of dojo yourself from the sounds of it.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think Holland is very martial arts oriented. It's just how it works here. You tough it out or you leave.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a normal thing. And it's like when I grew up, everybody was in martial arts. Everybody was doing judo and later on karate. And then, of course, the whole karate emergence happened because of the Karate Kid, which is something we haven't talked about. It's like the effect of this movie on basically the sport of karate and the karate industry. I mean, it was huge. This had a major cultural impact.
Seiko, how old were you when that movie came out?
I was 11. I was already practicing karate, and then it came out. And then, of course, you get the fights in the schoolyard, right? Because everybody is into karate. And like I said, we talked about ethics. What was drilled into me is you do not hit non-trained people. You just don't. You take a punch. You do not embarrass your dojo. Because if you hit someone and he can't defend himself and you have superior skill, then you lose your honor. That's basically what was drilled into us. You do not step outside of the dojo that way. You do not fight or spar. If you want to fight, you fight in the dojo, nowhere else. On the mat, where we are surrounding you. That's basically how it worked.
And did people follow that, or was...
If you want to stay in the school, yes.
Okay. So if the dojo found out, essentially.
Yeah, and they would find out, because parents would know, teachers would know, people would complain in the school. So, I guess Holland is a little different in terms of social control, where people are watching out for each other's kids a little bit more. It's like, what's happening here? And they tend to nip things in the bud and have meetings on it and all that stuff.
Okay.
So if you're a problem child, then everybody already knows about it.
I see. Okay. Yeah. I think there's a bit of a cultural difference between like America and Holland for sure.
I mean, you have your school fights. That's normal. But you have your school fights the way they're supposed to be. You get in trouble with someone in a higher class. Those kids are just bigger and they can just beat you up. So those fights are short and they're just there to put you in your place, basically. You just run home crying and that's it. And the next day they've just forgotten about you.
Yeah, it's no big deal. Yeah, no. That is one similarity. I do recall that from school. I can say now, actually, having kids, at least in Canada, and I would suspect Holland too, it's very different now, the way schools look at that kind of thing and the way it's treated.
Yeah.
I got in fights at school, and like it was like you said, you got in a fight, and then next day it was over. And if if you were caught fighting, you might get some kind of nominal punishment in school, but nothing huge.
Yeah.
Nowadays, if you got in a fight with another kid in school, both sets of parents are being called into the school. There's a meeting. It's pretty serious. Like, bullying is looked down on. And
yes, and that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there's bullying and there's hazing. And I think people are starting to confuse the two. Bullying is evil. Hazing is just a way of adjusting to the group.
Yeah, it's an initiation ritual.
Right.
And I think it's generally seen by people as synonymous, which I don't think it is.
I don't think it is either.
But yeah, I do agree with you. It is perceived
because hazing is ritualized.
Yes.
Highly ritualized. And there's rules. There are schoolyard rules, and there are school rules, and there are dojo rules. And I mean, that's what you have as a kid. You're surrounded by rules. And it seems these days it's mostly let's let the kids do whatever they feel like doing and whatever they want to do at that moment and protect them as much as possible. So they're not really doing much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah. And it seems like Daniel, he had like the altercations there, but he didn't really accept any type of hazing or any type of things like that. Like, he kind of wanted to be in that school and he wanted to be the man.
Yeah.
Without having to go through any type of ritual like that.
Yeah. And it wasn't going to work.
No.
Yeah. And I think they cut out a scene because at some point there's a dance and he has this shower curtain thing.
Yeah.
And it's not really explained why he chose that specific costume. But to my way of thinking, that's probably Mr. Miyagi who rigged that for him so he could go to that dance without having problems with the other kids. I mean, I can see a scene where he's just complaining and he wants to see this girl that's going to be at the dance, but, you know, he's going to be picked on. And so Mr. Miyagi says, you know, you could just wear a shower curtain. Nobody will see you.
But that wasn't in the movie.
It's just he's just in a shower curtain.
Yeah, and to me, I would feel very vulnerable there because I can't see my surroundings or see who's coming. Anyone can throw anything inside there or do anything.
Yeah, and they will.
Yes.
Then he sees a opportunity for vengeance because the Cobra Kai guy is in the bathroom. He's like, I don't know, he's rolling a joint or something.
He is rolling a joint.
Daniel decides, well, I'm just going to avenge myself by squirting water on him or something.
Now, I don't recall, was it, I believe it was Johnny that was in the stall rolling the joint.
Yes, they're hard to tell because you can't tell them apart because they're all in makeup, but yes.
But if I remember right, though, it wasn't Johnny that threw anything at him. It was one of his guys.
Yeah.
So Johnny gets the retribution for something he didn't do, which was odd to me.
Yep. But he's Cobra Kai, so he's part of that whole Cobra Kai thing, so.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the situation completely escalates, goes running home to mommy, and almost causes a traffic accident. That was interesting.
Which does. After the dance, there's like three cars.
What is that? I mean, that's not really normal behavior.
No.
Why would you run into traffic wearing a shower curtain and causing a traffic accident? I mean, those cars could have run into something.
Well, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, people.
We're looking at people getting whiplash and you name it.
That could have happened. We saw those cars collide, albeit at low speeds, but still.
Yeah. Avildsen didn't much care about the drivers of those cars and what happened to them. Anyway, Daniel runs and the Cobra Kai guys catch up to him and then they turn completely psychotic and they almost kill him. Because that's not a normal... I mean, to my way of thinking, when you're 16, 17 years old, and you're having a fight like that, you just let the two guys fight it out. You don't take turns.
Yeah.
That's not normal behavior.
No. Like, the other guys would be watching out to make sure no one runs in on Daniel's defense.
So this might
be... Which is not an issue because he has no other friends, really.
He has no friends. Which, he's been in that school for a couple of months. Aren't you making any male friends? Or are you hitting on all their girlfriends? Is that the problem?
Yeah.
He's a little girl-obsessed, our friend Daniel, isn't he?
Yeah, and to be fair to Daniel, though, that is that guy's ex-girlfriend.
Yeah.
And so it's like...
It's ex. deal with it, right?
He should respect her wishes that she does not want to be with him anymore.
Boundaries, Johnny, boundaries.
Yeah, boundaries. He's a good-looking guy. He's popular. He's rich. He could get another girl.
Sometimes
you want what you can't have, too.
True. But you could sort of say that gang beatdown he faces, that's Kreese's influence, that's their sensei.
Yes.
Not teaching them the ethics they have to know in order to function outside of the dojo.
Well, 100%, because even one of Johnny's friends says, like, that's enough. Like, we've roughed this kid up enough. Like, I think he's got the message.
Mm-hmm.
And then Johnny, he wants to take things further and really hurt him. And that reminds me of later in the film when the Cobra Kai instructor orders one of his students to hurt Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to take him out of commission.
Right. Sweep the leg and stuff.
Yeah. The guy's like, I could beat him. He's like, well, I don't want you to beat him. I want you to take him out of commission. Like that. Yeah. That seems like the same kind of attitude as Johnny had at the fence there when they're all roughing him up.
Yeah. And Johnny is a two-time champion. So they have probably done that little strategy before where they take out a opponent that could threaten their position.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so Bill Conti also wrote the score for both Rocky and for Karate Kid. Of course, the Rocky score is the Rocky score. I mean, that's probably one of the greatest scores ever written and up there with Star Wars and Jaws and Indiana Jones and all the good ones. How memorable is the Karate Kid score?
Well, in my opinion, it's not.
No.
I'm not even saying it's a bad score.
It's okay. It's functional. It's good for the movie. And it's cute.
It doesn't take away from the film. Like at no point you think, oh, why are they playing this music? Honestly, though, the song I remember most from it is Cruel Summer by Bananarama.
Right.
Which is, of course, not Bill Conti.
No.
But I don't think, like, and you even hear that with Cobra Kai. They bring that back.
They bring it back.
So,
yeah.
Now, when I hear Cruel Summer, I don't necessarily think of Karate Kid right away, but to me, that's the most memorable. And that tells me that the rest of the tracks aren't that memorable, you know, and not to insult Bill Conti. I think he did a fine job, but it was average.
Yeah.
Like you're not going to hit a home run every time. Rocky was excellent and it was outstanding, but you're not going to do that with every score you do, with every film you do.
Well, Conti is a master of writing scores to evoke emotion. I mean, if you look at like Rocky, if it didn't have that score, you wouldn't like Rocky as much, or you wouldn't believe in the romance as much as with it, right? Because that music just lifts your heart.
Yeah, we've discussed that on our podcast before.
Yeah, and I argue that in Karate Kid, it does the same thing, but not for Daniel. It does that for Mr. Miyagi, who is kind of the heart of the movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, because we've been discussing, Daniel is not the most likable character in general, but Mr. Miyagi is fairly likable.
Yeah, and I think
fairly notable.
Exactly, and I think the dynamic here is that we like Daniel through Mr. Miyagi's eyes, because Mr. Miyagi is turning him into somebody. Mr. Miyagi is assuming the role of the father figure, the sensei, the mentor, and he's fixing Daniel. He's teaching him life. He's teaching him how to be in balance because he's an unbalanced teenager.
Yeah.
And the music, to a large extent, I think, supports this, because at the end of the training, you see Daniel training on his own and teaching himself the crane kick and stuff like that. And that's basically Mr. Miyagi's theme over Daniel. And that's kind of saying, now he gets it.
Yeah. And Mr. Miyagi shows a weird level of respect for Daniel that's hard to fathom almost. Like, he's very generous with him. He gives him a car at the end.
Yeah.
But also, he calls him Daniel-san.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a serious sign of respect.
Yeah, like the for Japanese, they call the honorifics, and they have a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. I just looked up on my phone what they are here, but I had a good friend in high school who was an exchange student from Japan, and he called me Kaila-kun, kun being the honorific there, which is what you call a friend.
Right.
Like he would never call me Kaila-san, because that's what he would call like a teacher or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe not a teacher. That's not a good example. Teacher would be like sensei or senpai.
Mr. Miyagi calls Daniel Daniel-san, which is a little odd, except when you think about it in terms of later on, you have this drunk scene, right?
Yes.
Where he grieves for his dead wife, and his wife died in childbirth. So he lost both his wife and his son. And this happened while he was away fighting in World War II. This is interesting because they were living in the United States. So that means his wife was interned while she was pregnant. She was in a concentration camp.
Yes.
They don't talk about this in the movie, but all Japanese people were interned during World War II. They were in a concentration camp.
Yes. Even United States citizens who are Japanese ancestry.
Exactly. But the men could fight. So they had, I think, two or three divisions of all Japanese American men.
Yes.
Apparently, Mr. Miyagi was in one of them, probably the 441st, which is the one that's decorated the most, because they did have a tremendous amount of both losses and Medal of Honor count. So apparently Mr. Miyagi is extremely brave. And while he was fighting for his new adoptive country, his wife died in a concentration camp, giving birth to his son, probably under really shitty circumstances.
Yes.
So he's calling Daniel Daniel's son. And I don't know, if you think about it in terms of how the Japanese culture, there's a lot of obsequiousness, very respectful of your elders and people who are higher in station. So apparently either he considers Daniel, because he is what, a full-blooded American, his superior, or, which is more of my theory, it's he shows Daniel respect because Daniel is alone, without a father, probably lives in fear. You know, he has teen angst. Not just that, he's bullied and he's in unfamiliar surroundings. So it is a way for Mr. Miyagi to show him deference.
Yes. And Daniel seems to be a proxy for his own would-be son.
Mm-hmm.
That he could give Daniel things like the car. He can show Daniel his craft. Because remember, he says his father taught him martial arts. His father taught him basically everything of value he learned from his father.
Yes.
So that's important to him. And now he's passing it on to Daniel. Daniel's this son that he never had, this son that he grieves over.
So really, and he's not saying Daniel-san in the Japanese way. He's saying Daniel's son in the Western way.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I buy that. Could be. It's possible.
Because this is convoluted. This is confusing.
It is.
But the relationship between Mr. Miyagi and Daniel is sort of confusing.
Yes, it is an unlikely relationship.
But Mr. Miyagi's lonely.
He is lonely. He lives almost like a monastic type of lifestyle in this little compound. And he has his job where he's the maintenance guy, which is obviously below his capabilities. Like he's a very capable person, not only as a martial artist, but he is a Medal of Honor winner. Mm-hmm. He was a non-commissioned officer in the military. Like he could do a lot of things, but he has this kind of crappy job. But then he has his little area of solitude he goes to.
And that place is amazing.
Yeah.
So all his energies are into finding some kind of balance in his surroundings, because he's balance obsessed.
He is balanced obsessed. And I think that's an area where he could control.
Right. And he is out of balance in terms of he lost his wife and he lost his child. That's what that scene signifies. And so Daniel, he recognizes apparently really quickly as this is my chance to pass on what I've learned. This is my chance to teach, my chance to be a father in a way.
Yeah, 100%.
And that brings him balance.
It does. It does, because it's not in our nature as human beings to be solitary for long periods of time.
Yeah.
And we really need to be with other people, and we need to pass things on.
Of course, we're all filling in the blanks here because the movie doesn't answer these kinds of questions and never intended these questions to be raised at all. I don't think Addison ever considered that. I'm pretty sure he never considered anything about Rocky. He just figured, well, Stallone wrote a nice script. Let's see what we can do with it. But here we are 40 years later, obsessing over every little detail.
Yeah, I do not think he could have predicted the impact of podcasting.
No, definitely not.
Decades after the fact.
We're like the Trekkies of the 70s. We're nitpicking everything.
Yes, that's a good way to say it.
The Miyagi character is a father figure. Originally, it was supposed to be played by a Japanese actor called Shoko Sugi, who I know from all kinds of ninja movies. So I think the original script had a lot more fighting for Mr. Miyagi to do. But ultimately, they cast Pat Morita. And if you know a little bit about Pat Morita, he's a comedian. He has no martial arts background. He was famous already because he was a really big part of Happy Days.
Right.
And so everybody knew who he was. He was a household name in many ways. So he had a hard time getting cast for this, but ultimately they just took a chance on him because they probably saw, well, this is a role that has a little bit more layer to it. So we need someone with a lot of experience, and we have a lot of novice actors here. I mean, Ralph Macchio, it was in his second big role. His first role was in Scorsese's The Outsiders, and he was in an ensemble cast with like other very hungry but good young actors. So they cast Pat Morita. I think he just brought so much more to the role than they originally thought he would.
I would suspect so. I think it was smart to cast him as opposed to someone with less acting experience and more martial arts experience, because I think it would have been a shame if the movie had more of Mr. Miyagi fighting. I don't think that's really Mr. Miyagi's place to be fighting. His place is as a mentor and a teacher. I think the one scene where we did see him fight serves a purpose to establish some credibility that he is actually good at martial arts. Mm-hmm. He's not just a quack.
Yes, he can beat up high school kids.
But I think it would have been, Well, you know what? Beating up like five of them at a time might be difficult. But he beat them up convincingly, so like it wasn't a challenge for him.
And those kids were like black and blue and the next day, and they had their arms in a sling, and they were messed up.
I do find it hilarious, by the way, with the arm in the sling. We do see the scene when they're in the dojo and they're doing their punching drill, which is the only move we see them do in the dojo.
They only do punching drills. Yeah.
It was in one arm too. And in the punching drill, if you recall, the guy with the sling, that was his punching arm that was like that, but you could still see him kind of moving.
Yeah.
Like, why is he there? I don't know.
Because Kreese does not accept excuses like a hurt arm. Too bad.
No.
Suffer the pain.
Exactly. But I think it would have been a big mistake, for example, if Kreese and Miyagi fought it out. Like, I think some people would be tempted to have it there. Like, oh, that'd be so cool to see them, the two of them fighting in that film.
Yeah, and it would send exactly the wrong message.
Exactly. Yeah. So to me, it's not a big deal that you have a Miyagi character who doesn't fight a lot. I think it's actually preferable. And so the smart move is to hire someone who can act and who can play off that role as a mentor convincingly.
Okay, so there's this famous YouTube video, and it's called Daniel is the Real Bully. And,
yes.
According to rumor, this because it went viral, this was actually the linchpin of getting Cobra Kai greenlit.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was so popular. And that and Cobra Kai has a huge, and I mean a huge following. And I don't mean the TV show, but the group, the Cobra Kais, from the original Karate Kid, ever since, everybody always felt that, you know, the Cobra Kais were kind of the cool guys of the movie, and they were wronged in many ways. Here you have this kind of cute YouTube video, and I encourage everyone who's listening to look that up and see it. It's really entertaining. It's really funny. It kind of takes a devil's advocate look at the original Karate Kid. Daniel's a real bully because Johnny is really the victim. It's kind of a propaganda piece. Everything is taken out of context, and he's just made to look like a complete douchebag.
Yeah.
But that does bring up another interesting thing. If the situation was reversed, let's say Johnny would come to New York and Daniel was in his element with all his buddies, would Daniel be a worse bully if Johnny was hitting on his girlfriend?
Yeah, I think so.
Ex-girlfriend.
Daniel, to me, seems like a really good ringleader type of guy. You know, he has his New Jersey kind of accent, too, where he kind of gives you a bit of a mob type of vibe here.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
Italian-American.
Kind of street Italian kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, you could see him in the role as some kind of ringleader surrounded by thugs, where he's not necessarily beating up on you, but his friends are.
Right.
And this Johnny guy comes in and he thinks he's the shit because he's tall and good looking and capable. And then Daniel and his crew brings him down a peg. Yeah, I'm sure that could happen.
Yeah. You come bring your karate feet to a baseball bat fight, right?
Yeah, something exactly. Like that.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting because Avildsen casts Ralph Macchio on purpose because Ralph Macchio had a big chip on his shoulder and he wanted that to come through because he wanted Daniel to be a fish out of water for a reason, right? Because he has a big mouth and his mouth gets him into trouble, etc. And so what you really have to, I guess, kind of rate is, did he do a good job with building Daniel into the hero? Is this a good hero's journey, or does he leave stuff on the table?
I would say he left a bit on the table there. Yeah. I was not convinced of the hero. Like, I didn't have the same satisfaction, for example, when Rocky lost the first fight against Apollo Creed, but wanted to go the distance, right? Like, you have that. At the end of that fight, you feel like you've been through a fight and you feel his elation that he survived that, basically.
Yes,
that
it's so much of a high that you don't care if who wins or loses. It's you know, he survived. Yeah. He's standing. He gets the girl.
Yeah. And then, like, with Karate Kid, with the fight at the end, like, they hurried that tournament up so quick. Like, they went through that tournament very quickly. Not really until he gets hurt and you're seeing, okay, well, what's going to happen now that he's hurt. Also, I'd like to point out, I find Mr. Miyagi's healing powers to be very odd.
Like,
like, is he magic? Like, I thought that was really weird. Like, I could maybe see you do some chiropractor kind of stuff where he cracks something and you pop my shoulder back in. Thank you or something. But he does his hand rubbing.
Yeah.
With magic powers, I thought that kind of takes away a little bit.
Yeah, that's plot armor.
That's no cut me, Mick type of stuff. But yeah, at the end, I didn't feel super glad for Daniel that he won. I don't really feel like he deserves to win a karate tournament there.
No, there were some guys in that tournament who really deserved it.
Yeah, like I've been in some tournaments and I've had mixed degrees of success. But it's like when you do get a medal in a tournament, you feel a real sense of pride and accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And like Daniel did a quick, like, 6-week camp or however long it was, and then lit up a bunch of black belts and he wins the tournament. To me, that seems kind of shallow.
Yes, but it does help him find balance in his life. That's the idea behind it.
Sure. Yeah.
That the vendetta with the Cobra Kai's is now over because Daniel won. And here's the interesting thing. Johnny takes the trophy and hands it to Daniel and says, "You're all right, LaRusso." So that's basically the end, happy ending. Because the happy ending is not that Johnny got beaten. The happy ending is that Johnny accepts Daniel as his equal. Therefore, there's no reason to bully him anymore.
Which is interesting because kind of getting back to what you were saying about growing up in Holland, about how when you went to the older dojo and you scored a point on someone, that there's repercussions there. You would think something similar might happen here where you basically embarrass this dojo, this whole Cobra Kai dojo.
Yeah, this bunch of psychotics.
Everybody.
This gang.
Like, what's the instructor going to do next class, right?
Right. Well, he's going to punish all the guys.
Yeah,
he's basically sick, gonna call them losers, and you didn't. Yeah. We're gonna train harder, and you're all gonna be punished. That's because that's who Kreese is. He's insane,
and they're gonna resent Daniel for that.
Yes,
of course, not their abuser, Kreese.
No, because he's their savior.
Yeah.
Yes, that's usually how cults like that work.
Yes. Right? Yes. So, to me, the idea that, oh, if he beats him at the tournament, the bullying will stop, I'm skeptical.
So am I. And we did get a sequel.
Yes.
But that goes in a very different direction.
Yeah, and like, I try to look at it, too, from the perspective of just the movie as well, where it's like, oh, what you think would happen type of thing versus what happened in the sequel.
Yes.
Because, like, for example, like Rocky 2, to me, is kind of a logical sequel, but I almost would have preferred the mystery of what, if like none of the Rocky sequels were made, what happens to Rocky after this, or does it matter? And it's like, I kind of like that idea of just thinking of it in terms of just the one film.
If you look at it from a sports perspective, as a sports movie, the Rocky 2 thing needs to happen. I mean, if you have someone who comes that close to becoming champion, then there's money to be made from promoting a second fight.
Well, yes.
This makes perfect sense. And if he actually wins the title, eventually there would have been a third fight. Which,
There's been many boxing trilogies throughout the years.
Great ones.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the Creed Rocky fight, in my opinion, is based off the trilogy of Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier.
Sure.
Loosely based off of it. Yeah.
Inspired by.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So here's this tournament. Of course, this tournament becomes legendary in the Cobra Kai series. That's the reason why you watch the Cobra Kai series, because it's the member berries of how the original Karate Kid felt.
Right.
Right. And so when I was a kid and I would watch this, I was like, I would be amazed by that tournament, because the tournaments I went to would be in a gymnasium, a high school gym. It would be intensely boring compared to what I would see on this film. So I kind of looked into it, and there was no real tournament. They had 500 extras. They had an audience that was there as an extra, and they had all these martial artists and all these kids who were in, I would assume, karate schools, who were doing their thing. And Avildsen hid the cameras to give it a more natural feel. And he had like this huge crane, so he could do this gigantic pan shot of the opening scene when Daniel walks in and you see the scope of the tournament. The actors all say that the shooting of that tournament felt real to them, because they've been trained for that specific tournament to perform. By the way, the guy who's the referee of the tournament is actually the trainer of all the actors. And
makes sense.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. And so they had these ringers who would be the opponents of the Cobra Kai, like the Asian gentleman is a famous Filipino karate champion. Yeah. And I mean, he's obvious, by far the most skilled and athletic person in the entire tournament. And it's kind of patently ridiculous that he's defeated at all. But, for the purposes of the movie, okay.
Sure.
But if you look at the styles of the differences in styles of Miyagi-Do, which I think is based on the original Goju-Ri, if you look at the difference in style in terms of Cobra Kai, most of the Cobra Kai stuff, I was watching it and I was thinking, that's not karate.
No. When I was looking at your question before there, I was thinking, okay, what style is Cobra Kai? And I was like, I don't think it is.
It's a mix mash.
Well, because we, like we said, we don't see in their dojo what they do. All they do is this punching drill, which to me actually is not the way you do a punching drill in karate. Nope. Also, in the tournament, and
you count in Japanese for one.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Instruction. Like all the moves are in Japanese. Like if you said it to me in English, I'd have to think about it.
Yeah.
What they are.
Yeah. People talk about cartwheel kick, and I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. One thing I've noticed too, with the, in just watching them fight in the fight scenes and also the tournament, a lot of spinning kicks are used,
which you would never do in a tournament because it's it makes you so vulnerable.
Yeah, it's very risky. And when I do not train in spinning kicks at all in karate, and you could say maybe that's just the style of karate I'm in. I'm in Shitoryu style, which is similar to Shotokan. But the style I'm in is a mix of Shotokan, but it also has what you call the Nihate style, which is what Goju Ryo is based on.
Okay. So is that as kata based as other styles are?
Shitoryu is probably the most kata based style. Like you have to know, like if you're a black belt, you have to know like a couple dozen katas. Type of thing. We're actually Goju Ryu. Now you base, there's like five katas, but you have to do them basically perfectly. Like I know probably like seven or eight katas at this point,
right?
Maybe more, but I can't do them all perfectly, right? Because there's so many of them. The moves that they do that Miyagi's teaching him, the paint the fence, wax the car, those are moves that is part of the Nihate part of our style, which is similar to Goju Ryu. Those do exist, but to be fair, I never see them in like sparring or any other type of karate. Like the paint the fence, like you block someone's arm going up or down or something, like to side to side. It maybe if you really know what you're doing in karate, you'd be able to, like, I'm sure my sensei could fight someone doing that kind of stuff, but I wouldn't.
Yes, that's interesting. Your sensei, you told me, was Pat Morita's stunt double in the movie.
Oh, okay. So the sensei I train with was not Pat Morita. The organization that I'm in, Genbukai International, it is run by Fumio Demura, who was the stunt double for Mr. Miyagi. He's based in Los Angeles, and he does movie consulting and also is in movies. Now, he's in his 80s, so he doesn't do much stunt double work anymore. But his health isn't as good now. He has kidney problems and other things. But he brought karate to the United States in 1965.
Wow.
And he's not from Okinawa, but he brought our style to the United States there. And it's international. Like, I'm quite sure we have dojos in Holland, for example.
If you really look at the main martial arts in Holland, it's Taekwondo. Taekwondo is very, very big here. And the same is as karate. And karate kind of evolved into Dutch kickboxing.
Yeah, makes sense.
And well, they have a natural physical advantage. Dutch people tend to be hardy and tall.
You guys are quite tall.
Yes, and whenever I was in a fight, it was always against some guy who was like 6'4 or 6'5 with this reach advantage. And it was just basically just warding off huge roundhouse kicks and running.
There's a documentary about him called The Real Miyagi. And some people say that Miyagi was kind of based off him.
Okay.
They look similar, hence why he was the stunt double. Given that, Hollywood's where the movies are made, he's the natural choice there. Told that if you go to his house, he might make you paint his fence. But it's not for training karate. That's just him getting you to paint his fence.
That's just, Well, that's the whole wax on, wax off thing, where you're being taught without you actually know that you're being trained at that point. To me, that just sounded like the Boy Scouts.
Yeah. Right? I think the idea is that you're developing muscle memory, I guess.
And work ethic. Then, and you learn to listen without questioning, stuff like that.
Yes. Yeah, so it humbles them a bit.
Right.
It is very humbling to clean a guy's car or to paint his fence or to work in his house all day.
Yeah, then you're Daniel needed some humbling, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
So there might have been some wisdom in Miyagi's madness there.
He knew what he was doing.
Miyagi almost seems kind of too... He seems stoic and like he's a good teacher, but he also seems a bit eccentric as well. He shows up to the tournament and they're like, so what's going to happen? He's like, I don't know. What are the rules? Not sure. Like it doesn't bother him, right? Like,
no, he's not there for this stupid tournament, and he's just there to fix the problem. It's like, okay, the problem is we have an issue with these Cobra guys. We need a surrounding where they won't kill us, where they have to adhere to rules that apparently they're not adhering to. Maybe this will work.
Yeah.
And I think you kind of sense this from Mr. Miyagi. It's like, he's actually amazed Daniel's getting that far. It's like,
yes,
you know, he probably expected him to just, you know, have a good couple of fights and okay, now let's go home.
Yeah.
I'll buy you ice cream on the way back.
Daniel to prove that he's legit. He can take a punch. He can give some too.
Yeah.
You know, maybe earn a little bit of respect.
Yeah.
From the Cobra Kai guys, which is what you would actually expect in a tournament, perhaps, if he's only training for 6 weeks or whatever it is.
Yeah. So really the situation is just escalated beyond Mr. Miyagi's scope and intention.
Yeah.
Daniel was never supposed to win the tournament. He was just supposed to do a good job and let's go home and paint some more fences. Because, you know, that garden is not going to weed itself.
Yes. And everything about Mr. Miyagi is patience and time.
Right.
He's working on his bonsai trees. He's working on his car. He's working in his little compound there. Everything is him doing little things over a long, long period of time. And that's kind of the Japanese way.
And everything about Daniel is urgency.
Yes. Yeah. So, I want this right now. I want to be the man right now.
Right. He keeps pulling on Mr. Miyagi to teach him stuff, to make him do things. So Mr. Miyagi turns that energy into something he can use.
Yeah.
So that's what their yin yang is, really.
Yeah, yeah. I guess they feed off each other in that sense.
Hmm. Well, I think that about covers the movie. Kyle, thanks so much for joining me on this this discussion about Karate Kid. Do you have any parting thoughts about this movie?
You know, I'd say Mr. Miyagi did.
Right.
More than anyone. Because I see myself as a bit more of like the Daniel character in the sense that the urgency we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. I could be a little impatient like that and not want to build something over time. And it's like when I see Mr. Miyagi and I see the way he does things, it's like I want to be able to emulate that, to have that patience, to be that kind of older man that's kind of built himself things over time.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of everything else, like of school things, things like that, I had to suspend a lot of disbelief for this movie. To be honest with you, it's not, in my opinion, the greatest film out there. Like it's not, for example, anywhere near, like I wouldn't even say Rocky's my favorite film, but I would say it's not that close to Rocky. I'd say Rocky's a higher quality film.
Definitely.
Karate Kid, it's a fun film. It's fun if you're looking at it just to, you know, you want to have a good time. You don't want to think super hard. You want to watch this movie or even kind of laugh at maybe some of the more ridiculous parts of it. It's a great film.
Sure.
And it's something it's a film that I could watch multiple times and still enjoy it. So it's good in that sense. But yeah, it's not something I would create, for example, an entire podcast series around, for sure.
Oh, be careful, because the guy who plays Kreese has his own podcast.
Well, I guess I'm not going to get invited.
When I look back on Karate Kid, it kind of makes me feel like it's one of the first movies where martial arts was taken seriously, where it wasn't just chop suey, you know, and it's centered around a very typical American concept of, you know, how do you get the girl? How do you win? And so they brought martial arts into that setting. It wasn't life or death. It was just a teenage movie. I like it because of that, because they could have done anything with Daniel LaRusso. It could have been about skateboarding, but instead they took karate. And up until that point, karate was seen as vicious and dangerous and, you know, killer death blow kind of sport, where in reality, it's actually very balanced and spiritual. It's really a great way to get in shape and center yourself. So I appreciated it for that. And of course, for all the movies that came after, it did allow for Jean-Claude Van Damme, and it didn't allow for Steven Seagal. I think those guys got a pass simply because of Karate Kid. Because one, the movie did well. Two, there is a more interesting side to martial arts. It doesn't always have to be done by an Asian.
I think that's what I was going to say, is that you see white people doing martial arts. And other than Mr. Miyagi, where you see him very briefly do martial arts, mm-hmm. everyone is just like your standard Americans doing martial arts.
Yes, it's for everybody. That's basically the message.
And if I'm a social justice warrior, I'd say, oh, okay, you've appropriated karate now, white people.
Yes, well, you know, Bruce Lee had a big problem when he brought his style of kung fu to the United States with the Wing Chun, with the kung fu community.
Right.
I mean, there's rumors that he was that they broke his back because he was teaching it to Westerners.
Right.
And, you know, there was a boxer war in China, after all, that where Western countries interjected themselves into China. Basically, the Chinese fighting schools rebelled, and those were martial arts trained men running into machine guns.
Yeah.
That's a movie I really want to see.
It is. Yeah. And it's not widely known about in American culture. Yeah. Like if you're a student of history, you do know it. But
I mean, in the boxing war, the West and the Western influence in China, we were the bad guys. We were 100%. Hurting Chinese culture. We were hurting China. And that whole boxing war is about that. And I would love to see a movie on that. But we'd need a Chinese Hollywood for that.
Yeah. Or even like the Opium Wars, too. Oh. Like it's all part of China's, like, what they call their century of humiliation.
Yeah, yeah. And it's taught in schools there, but we know very little about it, don't we?
Yeah, I wonder why.
It's not our finest hour.
No.
Okay. Well, again, Kyle, I really enjoyed podcasting with you. I hope this is the first of many. We'll see everybody next time.
Yes, and Sika, thank you so much for having me. I legitimately really enjoyed talking to you. It was a great way to spend my Sunday morning.
Excellent. Well, give my regards to Ryan.
I will do.
And we'll see you next time.
Okay, take care.